Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Theodore Narduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. How are you? What's new?
I'm all right, thank you. New is I have a new book recommendation. Will that do?
They're coming. Absolutely, that'll do. Yeah.
I would say they're not coming thick and fast anymore, but there's a steady drip, I'd say.
That doesn't sound very nice, but okay.
It's a good steady drip. I don't know where this is going. Okay. But this week, Yasmin Ergas has been in touch about a bookshop that she encountered on a trip to Trieste. It's the Libreria Antiquaria Umberto Saba. So this is a very interesting place, which anyone who knows the city will know about, I think. I mean, even if the rather melancholy work of the poet himself, Umberto Saba, isn't probably that well known anymore. I think there's a statue outside the bookshop somewhere, so people might remember that more than they remember the bookshop. But it's this incredible, incredible place. It's been around for more than a century. It's changed its name. I think it's changed its location once or twice. It was owned by Saba for a while. He bought it from someone else. But then the fascist laws against Jewish people saw him. He basically had to transfer it to someone else. And I think it's still in that family. So it's still independently owned, which is, of course, part of our criteria. It's been a haunt of Italo Svevo, James Joyce, your friend, Lucy Dallas.
You
never met.
No, 100 years ago, maybe. I can't do my maths. But yeah, he was a friend of Umberto Saba, wasn't he?
Well, yeah,
and of Svevo, obviously.
Well, and Italo Svevo, yeah. And so it just made me think of that piece that we ran a couple of months ago about whether Italo Svevo and James Joyce were actually friends. Because I wanted very much to imagine them saying, oh, I'll meet you at the Libreria. And maybe they did.
I bet they did. I tell you, especially if they had wine there, I bet they did.
I'm sure that cinched the deal.
That would do it.
But these days, I think you're more likely to find Claudio Magris, Laszlo Krasnokai. I think he's a Trieste resident, so I bet you he goes there. But yeah, it's a magical place that, for all of its history, doesn't feel remotely museum-like. It's still, you know, living, breathing, working, useful.
Is it only antiquarian books? Have you been there?
No, it's not all antiquarian books. I mean, I think it made its name for, you know, rarities and things like that. But you can just go and get any book, really, I think. I mean, haven't been in a while, but that certainly was the case. I think that's what I mean by it's a useful place. It's a place where you can go and work there. You know, you won't get chased out
It's good to know if time
your laptop
time
in
and over here. Oh, I thought you wouldn't get a job.
No, I mean, if you're working away on something and you're lonely at your kitchen table, you could take yourself down there, have a coffee.
I'd love to go there because I'd love to go to Trieste.
Well, there you go. So yes, thank you very much to Yasmin for reminding us of it. You'll notice that we've broken with all convention here. And although Independent Bookshop Week has been and gone for this year, we're still keen to hear from you with your recommendations. So tell us about your favourites. Tweet at the TLS or email us on letters@the-tls.co.uk. Now, coming up on this week's show, war permeates the arts in the United States, creating, according to our writer Alice Kelly, the most militarised civilian culture in the world. Alice Kelly will tell us more about the influence of war on American literature and culture. And we have a new poem by Andre Nafis Saley, At the Graves of Labour's Fallen, read by the poet himself. But first, Lucy, what are we going to talk about?
we are going to talk about travel and travel writing, because you might think that since travel has been so severely restricted for so long, that writing about it might be withering on the vine or disappearing into thin air, but maybe not. The demise of travel writing has been predicted regularly since the 19th century, says our reviewer, Noor Sarah Weaver, and it's always sprung back to life. Noor reviewed a book called The Travel Writing Tribe, Journeys in Search of a Genre by Tim Hannigan, and we're delighted that she's here today to talk to us about where travel writing goes from here. Noor, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's jump in then. How does Tim Hannigan write about travel writing? What kind of form does his book take?
Oh, it's a really interesting way that he does it. He basically kind of twists the genre on its head, as he describes it. And he goes around interviewing famous travel writers in their own homes, which I found fascinating, because the only time you ever hear about these people is through their books and through their travels. And so seeing them in their kind of domestic habitats was... you know, it was really sort of fascinating, and the conversations were incredible. You know, they said things that really surprised me about travel writing.
So he's turning it round on them, as it were, because he's the traveller, and they're the people being observed. And do you get insights into what they're like from their own homes, as it were? Because some of those travel writers, particularly when he goes to see Sarah Wheeler. She talks about a story that's in Colin Thubron's book, Behind the Wall, about a barn owl.
Yeah.
And it's very funny. In the story, you say in your piece, the author, so Colin Thubron, buys a barn owl in a Chinese market, smuggles it onto a train, and then releases it through the window. And Sarah Wheeler has quite a bracing reaction to this.
Yeah, she's just like, bollocks. Absolutely bollocks in it. I was really shocked when she said that.
I was quite shocked when I read it.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, I mean, they are friends, so you know that should be stated. But yeah, I was really surprised by her candor. And I don't know if they've had a conversation about it. It'll be very interesting to see. Maybe after this piece comes out, he'll have a response for it. But I don't know. I mean, travel writing is interesting because there's always been this. Suspicion lingering over it that the writers are making things up. I mean, I get asked that a lot, you know, have you embellished your stories? And the thing is that, you know, real life is often stranger than fiction. And there are things that happen on your travels that as you're writing it, you're thinking, oh God, no one is going to believe this, but it did actually happen. And I guess with Colin Thubron, it does sound very poetic, this idea of buying a barn owl and then releasing it on a night train, you know, but it's not impossible. But yeah, you know, there is an element of, you do have to shift things around sometimes in travel writing.
Yeah, well, I was going to talk about that. And of course, I mean, you know about that yourself. And you talk in the piece about the idea of retrospective invention, which is a very nice way of saying making stuff up, isn't it? And people often think most strongly of Bruce Chatwin and songlines, but he wasn't the only one, was he?
No, I mean, you had people, well, Hannigan himself, the author of this book, he went through Wilfred Thesiger's travel diaries, and he found discrepancies between the author's private accounts and his published works. There's a lot of apparently in a lot of these travel authors' books, they tend to come across as being alone. They're taking this journey by themselves, when in reality, they had a local guide with them. But in the book, all of those companions disappear. And he found that with Thesiger's diaries, that was very much the case. And so, you know, for me, that's not exactly a lie. I guess you're stripping down the reality of what's happened. You're rubbing people out of the story, which doesn't make it fake, I suppose, but it does, you know, for someone like Wilfred Thesiger, who comes across as this, you know, very adventurous traveler, you know, going through the deserts and what have you, to then find out that, you know, he had other people with him, and you know, it does take something away from that sense of, you know, him being this lone adventurer.
In terms of it being, you know, dominated by a kind of white upper or middle class men, apart from just the straightforward inequality of that, there's also the danger of everything being seen from one point of view. And I don't even mean one person. I mean, you know, one quite particular point of view, and that this is, we are us and everything else is them. Do you think that's moved on a bit now?
It has. I mean, with this particular book, the author does say that he had a criterion for which writers he would include. And so they had to be English language, and they had to have written two books, at least two books. And so on that basis, Hannigan did have to exclude quite a few writers. I mean, there have been, you know, lots of travel writers out there who aren't white, male, public school educated, et cetera, et cetera. But obviously, you know, they were the people who were the most prominent, you know, writers of that genre. And so, you know, they have dominated it. But, you know, that is starting to change. Unfortunately, it's changing at a time when travel writing has become such an expensive genre. You know, as an author, you need an advance, you know, of at least 5,000 often to do your journeys. And so this idea of travel writing as the preserve of people who have a certain socioeconomic privilege, I think, is still more relevant today than it was in the past. And so, yeah, you know, it is a bit problematic. You have people like Bruce Chatwin writing the song lines. It's all about Aboriginal culture, and yet he didn't talk to a single Aborigine while he was out there. And I think that was something you could get away with in the 70s and 80s. You certainly couldn't do that now.
Yes, I suppose, yes, if he went out and did that now, you know, presumably people would be tweeting within about 10 minutes and going, no, it isn't.
Exactly. Exactly.
Why didn't you talk to us?
Yeah.
And can you tell us about Hannigan's four figures of travel writing and what their kind of importance is relative to each other?
Yeah, well, he identifies, you know, four elements within travel writing. So you've got the writers themselves of these books. Then you have the readers. Then you also have scholars, like academics, travel writing academics, who, you know, have examined the genre over the decades. And then you have what Hannigan describes as the travelees, which are the subject of the travel writer's books. So basically the people, the inhabitants of the country or society that the writer is talking about. And so, you know, Hannigan explores the dynamic between these four pillars, and he talks to all of these, like, you know, people who represent each of those pillars. And what was quite interesting was that when he talked to just ordinary readers of travel books, he was surprised to find that they weren't actually that bothered by the idea of fabrication, like particularly in Bruce Chatwin's case, even though he made up a lot of his dialogue and the things that happened in the song lines. Hannigan finds that readers were actually, you know, they didn't mind. They thought, well, actually, this book introduced us to this Aboriginal culture that we knew nothing about. And so, you know, travel writing actually is interpreted by some people as simply an introduction to a place or a society or, you know, certain concepts. And that perhaps scholars who are very critical of travel writers in terms of fabrication or egocentricity, whatever it might be, I think scholars often overestimate how much the reader believes what's being written, you know, perhaps underestimate their intelligence.
And presumably also sort of spin their own theories to a degree. I mean, you get a real sense of these four different elements of travel writing being in a very complicated, sometimes very complicated dance with each other as to which is going to win out. And there's a funny anecdote that you share. I think it's Colin Thubron who attends a lecture on his own work, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like one major critique of travel writing scholars is that the authors treat their subjects as these kind of inanimate objects, you know, who don't really have a voice. But the irony is that the travel scholars themselves are doing that with regards to travel authors, and you know that they're talking about these authors, they're discussing their motivations, all of these things, without actually having a direct dialogue with those authors. And so, you know, Thubron finds himself at some travel writing conference at a university in Philadelphia, and he's sitting in the audience while a scholar is talking about Thubron's work, and you know, and Thubron just, you know, finds it bizarre. But in Thubron's case, he's been suddenly put in the shoes of the travelee, you know, and that sort of that weird position of passively listening to people discussing you and your mindset. So yeah, it was really that's what I loved about this book, is, you know, the way Hannigan, you know, interrogates these four pillars and actually has a creates a discussion between those four pillars, you know, which is something that he feels doesn't happen enough.
It's interesting as well, that idea about the readers, you know, not minding and presumably being able to hold different ideas in place at the same time. And I wonder if that touches on the genre thing again. Is there a genre problem or question? There's this question of, is it journalism? Is it memoir? Is it literature? Is it fiction, as we said earlier? Maybe the readers can hold all four of those at once. But do you think it tends in one way, or it's all of those things?
Yeah, I think travel writing often reflects the ambitions of the writer itself, themselves. You know, some writers see themselves as journalists. You know, Dublin Murphy is one example, and Samantha Subramanian. You know, for them, they're basically continuing where newspapers have left off. They're adding those, you know, intimate details that you don't get in news journalism. And you know, I sort of come from that perspective as well. You know, I went to journalism school, and it was while I was at journalism school that I thought, oh God, I can't do this. I don't want to be a journalist. I want to be a travel writer. I'm much more interested in those intimate human stories. But then, you know, there are other travel writers who you sense aspire to be novelists more than anything else. And, you know, I don't know whether Paul Theroux prefers to be a novelist or a travel writer. He's done both, but you can definitely see the sort of influence of fiction writing, you know, in his travel writing, and you know, and that's what made his travel writing so unique and interesting when he first came on the scene in the 70s. And so, yeah, it's a very subjective genre, and you know, the books that come out, you know, reflect very deeply on the writer themselves and their aspirations and what they want.
Insofar as we can categorize it, though, there is an interesting subcategory, I suppose, of reader experience, I think, which Hannigan touches on, which is when you see your own home or place that you feel close to written back to you by someone who isn't from there. There's an interesting tension in that, isn't there?
Yeah, so, you know, Hannigan finds himself in this position where he's reading about his own region. He comes from Cornwall, and the writer Philip Marsden has written about that part of the world. And so, you know, Hannigan discusses, you know, what it feels like to come from a place that's being discussed by a writer who's not from that place. And again, he has very mixed feelings. You know, on the one hand, he doesn't quite understand what the writer sees. You know, the writer sees something that he doesn't necessarily see, or, you know, that he recognizes it, but that, you know, the writers put it together, their observations, in a way that then becomes, you know, slightly unrecognizable to the person who's from that region. And I think we all experience that. Even when reading the newspapers, I remember when I was living in New York, and whenever the New York Times wrote about things that were happening in England, I thought, it's not exactly wrong what they're saying, but there was something that doesn't feel quite right, you know, about it. And that's how, you know, Hannigan feels about Cornwall. But, you know, he also felt a weird sort of pride as well. You know, he describes it as an unstable emulsion of outrage and pride in seeing, you know, his region, his hometown being othered and exoticized. But, you know, the truth is that quite often, and he acknowledges this himself, is that sometimes you have to have an outsider to write about your homeland or your home region, because there are things that you take for granted as someone who's from there. You know, there are things, there are observations that you would not make because they're so obvious to you. You're surrounded by it like wallpaper, and sometimes you need an outsider to come in and to point things out in that way. And I found that when I wrote my book, Looking for Trans Wonderland, I was traveling around Nigeria. And, you know, there are observations that I made that are just so obvious to Nigerians living in Nigeria that they would never think to make those observations. But those are some of the things that readers really connected with and, you know, found quite amusing. Like, you know, for example, I came across this page in the newspaper that's like, you know, part of the Lonely Heart section, and it's, you know, it's men looking for sugar mummies. And, you know, if you tell Nigerians about it, they're kind of like, oh yeah, you know, they're used to that. But, you know, for an outsider, it's like, oh my god, this is really interesting. And so you know, it's sometimes you do have to have an outsider come in and well, you know, it's outsiders who even think to write about it in the first place. But, you know, luckily we live in a world where we have so many multiple sources of information now that the travel book isn't this one, you know, sole keyhole, you know, look into a particular country, you know, or society. There are different sources now, and so that responsibility as a writer isn't as big as it used to be.
Yes, it's not like you're bringing back the truth about one place and nobody will ever know anything else. Everyone's now got lots of comparisons, I suppose.
Exactly. I mean, you know, you look at writers like John Mandeville from the 14th century, and he was a complete fabulous, you know, he made things up, you know, four-headed dragons and all sorts of
mermaids everywhere. And
dog-headed men and maidens with snakes in their vulvas, to be specific.
Exactly. You know, there's no one to challenge him. And even Christopher Columbus took this, you know, this John Mandeville's book and used it as a travel guide. You know, it's like,
imagine riding out and expecting to encounter those things.
Exactly.
So in this time of, well, first of all, everyone is severely restricted, and also in terms of climate change is another reason, that in a way we're being told not to travel. Well, what does Tim Hannigan see as the future of travel writing, and do you agree with him?
Yeah, I mean, he's not sure. He leaves it open-ended, but, you know, he sort of mulls the possibility that, you know, in a post-COVID world where we can't travel as much as we used to, that, you know, perhaps we might experience some kind of, you know, renaissance with travel writing, where people, you know, have to rely on others for that sort of information, you know, about foreign lands. I mean, that's quite, I guess, far-fetched. I mean, we're all sort of, you know, ready. We're all dusting off our passports and just, you know, waiting, dying to get on planes again. But you know, you never know. History has a way of repeating itself. And sometimes, you know, the future is not as futuristic as we like to think it is. You know, sometimes we can end up stepping back in time.
For a final question, apart from your own book, of course, what would you recommend that we read if we had, you know, one travel writer to read?
Oh my god! I'm
sorry. And you can just say yourself if you want. Just say
my
book.
No, no worry.
We could take an anthology.
No, okay. Can I have two?
Yes, it's not Desert Island Disc. You can have as many as you want.
Okay. I would say, I mean, there are many. So I love books by Derbla Murphy. I particularly like Sarah Wheeler's Terra Incognita. Then there's Tete Michel Pomasi. He was from Togo in West Africa, and he wrote An African in Greenland. That was a sensational book, really, really good, you know, just full of anthropological detail. And then there's Maximum City by Suketu Mehta, a sort of portrait of Bombay, I think in the late 90s or early noughties. So yeah, those are the books that I love the most.
Brilliant. Well, if we can't get there, we can at least read about it. So Noor, many, many thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Still to come on the show, the cultural impact of war in America from the Revolutionary War to the present day, and a new poem by Andre Nafis Saley. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can follow the TLS podcast from wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we turn to Alice Kelly in the subject of war and American literature, we're stopping off in Bisbee, Arizona, the setting of a poem, The Graves of Labor's Fallen, by Andre Nafis Saley. Andre joins us now to tell us more. Thank you so much for coming on, Andre.
My pleasure, Thea. Thank you so much for having me.
Our next item after you has to do with war and American literature, but the story at the heart of your poem sort of puts us in the context of war too, or a war sort of, doesn't it? It's about events that took place on July the 12th, 1917.
Absolutely right. And I think war is exactly the right term to apply. And I think to be more specific, in fact, on an unacknowledged war, we call them the first Red Scare, the second Red Scare. Arguably, I think that we're in the midst of a third Red Scare in many ways. But I think it's always been an unacknowledged conflict, one woefully swept under the carpet, or swept under the desert, really, in this case.
So what happened there? I think there were mine workers who were deported en masse because they were on strike, and I think the justification given at the time was that it endangered the US war effort, and so they were just, you know, summarily put onto to trucks or into train carriages and carted off.
That's absolutely right. When the miners went on strike, a lot of them belonged to the Industrial Workers of the World, a union that still exists to this day. And as you said, due to Woodrow Wilson's wartime policies, essentially copper mining was considered a matter of national security. And so the sheriff of Bisbee at the time, Harry Wheeler, was given the unthinkable level of power of essentially recruiting a posse made up essentially of thugs who then rounded up these men, women, and children and essentially deported them, not just out of Bisbee, but out of the state of Arizona entirely. And this was something that was repeated throughout this period of the first Red Scare and kept on going despite the end of the First World War. In fact, you're looking at a period that includes Emma Goldman's deportation in 1919. So this goes really beyond the First World War. It essentially took up a space of about 5 years in American politics, and the labor movement never really recovered until the Great Depression in the early 1930s. One thing I should probably say about the poem is that I was in Bisbee in the summer of 2018, visiting the graves of these fallen heroes of labor, essentially. And it was on the 101st anniversary of that event. And a local member of the union took a group of us around the cemetery, showing us around and telling us the history of not just the town and the movement, but also the individuals that were buried there. Most of the people who were deported never returned. They died elsewhere. Very, very few were able to come back. But of course, they lived out the rest of their lives almost in hiding because it was a company town. And they had the kind of power that really would best be befitting a medieval lord of some kind.
And I think it's clear in the poem that you were in Bisbee. I mean, there's such a strong sense of place in it. So I think when you're ready, please let's hear it.
Thank you. At the graves of labor's fallen. It is intolerable that these itinerants of anarchy should infest great regions of the West. New York Times, July 14, 1917. The best plots in the cemetery belong to cattle thieves, cutthroats, bushwhackers, or as any respectable boomtown would call them, our esteemed founding fathers. But by the northeastern corner of that acre of dust off the old Douglas Road stood the graves of the Wobblies, tall as cigarette stubs. Time had made most names illegible, but what little survived made it clear that half the world lay buried here in Bisbee. Mexicans, Greeks, Slavs, Italians. Some spelled down mine shafts, others grew old. all died poor. Some certainty, at least, in the otherwise unpredictable lives led by miners in copper country. Whoever said that America skipped its medieval stage? Nothing was left unscathed by that feudalism. Wandering holy men, roofless barons, armed thugs on horseback, peasants' revolts, the imaginary but ever effective specter of dark hordes at the gates. July 12, 1917. 1,200 Americans deported in a single morning. A posse, a roundup, then a 12-hour ride to Hermanos, New Mexico. All women and children keep off streets today, read the Bisbee Daily Review, but they were banished too. Blame public hysteria and spineless Woodrow Wilson. Blame General John Jay, bury them with pigs, Pershing, and his crusade against Pancho Villa. Consider also the Buffalo soldiers, too black to die for their country in France, but not too black to shoot at Mexicans on the border. Consider finally that no court hears such cases except that of memory. Come sunset, I speed down the gulch to Cochise and sing, work and pray, live on hay, you'll get pie in the sky when you die. That's a lie.
Andre Athis-Saley, thank you. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
A collection of poems, High Desert, will be published next summer. Now, two new collections of essays ask us to focus on the importance of war to the United States in terms of literary and cultural production. The first takes a long view, beginning with the Revolutionary War and carrying us through Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan as the last troops leave, while the second addresses the First World War specifically. Together, they paint a picture of a culture founded and fed on combat. As Alice Kelly points out in her review of the collections, even Snoopy harbors a fighter pilot alter ego. Alice Kelly joins us now to tell us more. Alice, hello, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the first of the two books then. Its title, War and American Literature, gives a pretty clear sense of how expansive it is. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a really wide volume, War and American Literature, edited by a First World War scholar originally, Jennifer Haytock. It's thinking about war as a prominent theme in American literature, as Thea outlined, from the Revolutionary War onwards. So it's no small task, I'd say. It's necessarily wide-ranging, it's diverse, it obviously can't be comprehensive, but it does a very good job of trying to both think about the major wars that have happened since that period, which, as we know, the American context has numerous wars that have happened since its beginnings, as well as thinking thematically and thinking about new directions for war studies. So it does a good job at the end of thinking about things like war and whiteness. That's something I pick up in my review, war and queer studies, war and eco-criticism. In general terms, it's great that it's thinking about war as a theme for American literature. And this is really important. The fact that we're still doing this in 2021 is very interesting, I think.
How so?
In that we still need a volume of this kind. When we think about how important war is to America as a uniquely military state, is how I talk about it in the review, as a state that is marked by war right from the beginning, as the country in the world that has the largest federal spend on its military. You know, it's $778 billion last year, which is three times that of its closest competitor, China. As a nation which venerates the veteran, holds ticker tape parades and military holidays, and in every way kind of builds the military into its civil society, it's very interesting that we're still only really just beginning to think about how does that play out culturally.
And as you say, I mean, it's quite a big ask of one book. So how does it go about it? How does it sort of structure itself? Is it organized chronologically or is it thematic?
It tries to do a bit of both, actually. So it's in three parts. The first part is aspects of war in American literature, which is touching on different aspects. The chapter that really stood out to me was there on the one on medical humanities and medical memoirs, ranging from early memoirs, you know, Whitman in the Civil War, up to present day memoirs coming out of the Forever Wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The next section is on cultural moments in the American literary imagination. That's more chronologically organized. And the third section is new lines of inquiry, as I mentioned. So things like war and whiteness, sort of themes that are very much in the critical zeitgeist. So very broad ranging, as I say, it can't be comprehensive. And I wondered about the chronology at the beginning, the chronology of war text, you know, what goes in and what doesn't go in. And there's still discussions ongoing in war literary studies about what do we classify as war literature? Does a piece of work written by a woman on the home front constitute a war text in the same way that a combatant narrative coming directly out of the Western Front is a war text? So I think all of those concerns are there in this volume. And I'm sure some scholars will say, well, perhaps you should have included this, but I think it really does a very good job of trying to include as much as it can.
And so did anything in this collection strike you as particularly original, whether in terms of approach or subject? You mentioned a study of J.D. Salinger, which I mean, that seems to me like quite an unexpected leap.
Yeah, exactly. So thinking about going back to the question of what do we consider to be American war texts, I'd say this is a conversation we're still having. What are the key American war texts? We can probably all name some that we think of when we think of America and war. Something very typical like the Red Badge of Courage from 1895, which one of the contributors, Stephen Trout, points out is, you know, the best known combat narrative of the Civil War, even though its author wasn't born while the Civil War was going on. It's somehow become the kind of key cultural novel of that war. But there are also, so there's readings of texts that we might expect to see here, Hemingway's In Our Time or any other number, William March's Company K, Heller's Catch 22, sort of war texts that we know of and imagine to be war texts. And then texts like J.D. Salinger, this reading stood out to me where in a chapter on veterans, the author Philip Beidler suggests that, I'm going to quote from him so as not to mischaracterize what he says, the troubled, disaffected, lonely teenage Holden Caulfield manifests significant symptoms of PTSD. So that's a reading that gives us a cultural text that's very important in the American literary canon, but getting us to think of it in a totally different context. So was in The Catcher in the Rye Salinger being in some way affected by what he saw around him, which was the increasing levels of PTSD? We may, you know, that may be a reading that people don't agree with, but it's still something interesting that makes us think of Holden Caulfield and his teenage malaise in a very different way, as perhaps indicative of a kind of wider cultural malaise itself.
Is there anything there about humour as well? Because it strikes me that when I'm trying to think of examples, I'm thinking of Kurt Vonnegut and Thomas Pynchon, and as you said, Joseph Heller. There's, I mean, weirdly, quite a lot of dark humour in there, isn't there?
Absolutely. I think the idea of treating war, treating violence with humour, coming back with a very darkly satirical mode, I think that's a key part of American 20th century literature, actually. I think that's a really important thing. I don't really talk about that in the review, but a response, which in some readings would be a kind of trauma response. We laugh at something when it makes us uncomfortable or when we don't know what else to do. It's an almost involuntary response, or as a kind of literary mode, a kind of satire, disillusionment. In the famous text that we use to think of in the British case of First World War writing is Paul Fussell's The Great War and Modern Memory from 1975. And he posits this argument for the idea of irony, that we always respond to the war through a sort of dominant mode of irony, that we have to think of it in an ironic term. And he talks about some of those American texts, actually. And humour is part of that. How do we respond to mass violence? We do it with a response that may seem counterintuitive, which is to laugh at it.
The second book narrows things down to the First World War. America isn't the first country one thinks of for that. As you say, the US wasn't involved for long or especially deeply. And yet this book makes a compelling case, does it, of that war's impact on cultural imagination?
It absolutely does. And I'm really, really pleased that it's come out. I think it's actually very important in that regard, because unlike the literary criticism around any of the other nations, the American case of First World War literary culture is, I would say, still being, we still have to make the case for it. you know, because in the American imagination, the First World War doesn't play a large part. It doesn't hold a part in the American cultural memory in the same way as something like the Civil War, which absolutely dominates war memory in the US, or the Second World War, which comes after it, or even Vietnam, which, you know, even though it's very problematic in the American imagination and American history, it still, I would say, holds a larger place for Americans than the First World War. And that's really strange. That's a really interesting cultural ellipsis to me, because America actually produced an enormous amount of literature and culture from this war. Part of that was to do with the Committee on Public Information, which was created as soon as America entered the war. It was headed by the mastermind George Creel, who mobilized every form of culture imaginable, you know, the cinema, literature, the radio, songs, whatever he could get his hands on to persuade the American people of the importance of being in this war, and produce an enormous amount of culture. But we don't actually think of American First World War culture as a genre in its own right, in the way that we might think of it in the British case with the poets, the First World War poets that we all read in school.
Mm. When you mentioned film, so there were American films about during the First World War and sort of promoting it, as it were there? Because thinking about later, you say it's the most militarized civilian culture in the world, and that seems especially prominent in film. I mean, there's so many films that, you know, with people in the army or soldiers or ex-soldiers doing things and you know, just enormous amounts of weapons and sort of hardware.
Absolutely. That continues today, whether it's explicitly about wars that are ongoing or whether we're seeing it coming out through superhero films. You know, the very interesting way that often these things are allegories for whatever wars America is in at that moment. I was teaching this term, Batman Begins, as an allegory for the Iraq War and everything that happens in the post 9/11 moment. That's a 2005 film, but I'm sure we can all think of recent examples of films that are in some way allegorizing America's position on the world stage. Well, during the war itself, during the First World War, there were certainly a number of films that were produced, propaganda films like Under Four Flags or Pershing's Crusaders. There was also really, I mean, I'm fascinated by this, how Hollywood mobilized in the cause of the war, because the cinema was, you know, becoming increasingly important, hugely popular with the American people. And one of my personal favorites is Charlie Chaplin, who not only made Shoulder Arms in 1918, where we see Charlie in the trenches, sidling into across the German lines dressed as a tree, managing to arrest 13 German soldiers and eventually the Kaiser and the Prince, and saving the day, only to be sadly awoken by his comrades and having to go over to fight, and it was all a dream. But he also self-funded a film called The Bond in 1918, which was entirely to promote Liberty Bonds, to put money into the American war effort. You know, Chaplin was British born, but he was the most famous film star in the world in 1918. And he knew that it made a difference if him and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. went and fooled around on Wall Street in that famous photo of them to promote war bonds to the American people. And his material that he was generating promoted the American cause. So the story of American Hollywood has been told by film scholars, you know, much more knowledgeable than me, but it's a very interesting case of how do we get an enormous cultural industry behind the war effort? And Creel at the CPI, the Committee on Public Information, knew that. He knew how important it was. And he also did this incredible thing, really, in propaganda terms, where he mobilized 75,000 volunteers in the 20 months that America was in the war, to go into the cinemas and theaters and to be called, they were the 4-minute men. They gave 4-minute spiels, which they wrote themselves. They were instructed on what should be in there, but they wrote it themselves to be so that their passion would come through. And in those 4 minutes in between the film reels being changed, they would promote the American war cause. They would tell the people in the cinema how important it was that they supported their country. And this was hugely successful. This was just one example, one of the numerous examples of how the American propaganda machine kicked in and how this war was enormously important for the American people, even though it's, as I said, not really remembered today. The American centenary of the First World War went off without fanfare. and the memorial to the First World War, it has been mired in mud, really. It's projected to be completed in DC in 2024, but it's, you know, it missed the centenary because it couldn't get enough, the committee couldn't get enough funding for it, which means there wasn't enough public support for it.
And in terms of the literature then, I mean, you mentioned an essay on the fiction by Scott D. Emmett. What does he cover there? I mean, is it fiction that was written at the time or things have been written since, you know, so developing that legacy of the war? I suppose I'm thinking of, I've been reading quite a lot of novels written in the build-up to the Second World War in Italy, and there was such a rich seam of very pulpy literature that, you know, fetishized the aeroplanes and patriotism and all of the sort of stuff you would expect. I wonder if, similar to those 4 Minute Men that you mentioned, there was a similar effort going on in novels at the time.
So I think there was both. There was both literature that was for the war and literature that was against the war. In general, this book is trying to go beyond the lost generation roster of writers that we think of when we think of the First World War. So they would be, I'm sure our readers know, people like F. Scott Fitzgerald or Gertrude Stein or Ernest Hemingway, writers that we associate with a disillusionment narrative of the war has ruined a certain generation, and going beyond to consider the texts that were produced during the war and after the war. And some of the chapters consider writing that comes much later, up to the present day, as well as writing that comes from the home front, writing that came from combatants, trying, as we're doing in all of First World War literary studies, to broaden out, to broaden the canon of what we consider to be war literature, and to think of it in not confined to the combatant narrative on the Western Front. So some of the writers, I may just talk about my own work here a little bit. Some of my own work is focused on Edith Wharton as an interesting example. I put a piece in the TLS in 2015. It was my first piece in the TLS, and it was an unknown short story by Wharton that dealt with the war. And that was a really interesting example to me because I believed when I put it in that it would be of interest to Wharton scholars and to, you know, readers, literary readers generally, but it wouldn't be much picked up beyond that. And what was interesting, you know, not to blow my own trumpet, but it was interesting to me because it generated international media coverage, and even Obama's Committee on the Arts and Humanities in the US picked up about it and tweeted about it. You know, I was interviewed by The Atlantic, and that was a really interesting, what do we call it, a learning experience for me, because it showed that there was this huge interest in writers that are very important novelists in the early 20th century that people didn't realize were also war writers. Wharton turns from writing something like The Custom of the Country in 1913 to suddenly mobilizing on behalf of the war effort and producing a lot of material that is aimed at convincing Americans to send money to France to fund the war charities that she has set up. And after the war, you know, she's writing for American soldiers in 1919. And then she turns suddenly and writes her most important work, I would argue, The Age of Innocence in 1920, which is in itself a kind of war text because she's absolutely eliding the memory of the war and going back to an earlier part of her lifetime, to her childhood, to the Gilded Age of her childhood. But it was interesting to me how much people picked up on Wharton as a war writer.
And it seems, I mean, it comes across so clearly in what you've been saying about both of these books, really. That idea of pieces of the puzzle that have been missing, I think, especially with the First World War here. You make a point, you say one book on the Civil War has been published every day since its conclusion in 1865. So there's a real sense of some serious catching up to be done.
It's a really interesting case of a culture that has a very interesting cultural memory of war. I say this having taught war to Yale freshmen in 2014, who were all young enough to barely remember 9/11, and being so struck by what is considered the major wars in that landscape. The First World War, which is hidden away, has been completely forgotten, even though it's also enormously important both for modernism and literary innovation and cultural innovation in the early 20th century, but also how the US becomes the country of the 20th century, how the 20th century becomes the American century, how it assumes that dominant position on the world stage and holds it for the next 100 years.
A very important new collection then. Alice Kelly, thank you very much for telling us about it.
Thank you very much.
That's all for this week. Our thanks go to Noor Wiwa, Andre Nafis-Saley and Alice Kelly. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Lee Meyer. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.